Good, so welcome back everybody. Welcome if you've just arrived. So, yes, I want to start looking at this text that I was talking about, or that I mentioned, which is called the Vimalakirti Nidesha, or the Holy Teaching of Vimalakirti. It's an ancient Indian text which comes to us in English via Chinese and... mainly by the Chinese translation, I think, this one. And then mainly what I'm going to do is not look at the text directly, but start to look at themes from the text as illustrated and commented on by Sangharakshita in this book called The Inconceivable Emancipation. This is based on a series of lectures that Sangharakshita gave in the 70s, I think, so nearly 79, so nearly 4 decades ago. And I'm not going to be able to do the lectures justice, so I really would encourage you to think about getting this book, The Inconceivable Emancipation. I'll just start to sort of talk about some of the themes that Sangharakshita talks about, and he's just talking about some of the themes that the original text is talking about, yeah? So the original text, the Vimalakirti Nidesha, Nidesha means the teaching, the holy teaching, and Vimalakirti is a name of a person. I nearly said man, except he's more than just an ordinary human being. He's a bodhisattva in this text. A bodhisattva is somebody who's committed to gaining enlightenment, not just for themselves, but for the benefit of all beings, committed to gaining liberation so that they can then benefit all beings and help them gain liberation. And in this text, Vimalakirti is pretty much as enlightened as the Buddha is. The Buddha is still around in this text, but we're no longer in historical India of 2.5 centuries ago. The life story of the Buddha that we've been focusing on, actually even then we've been focusing rather on our imagination rather than sort of historical accuracy. But the Vimalakirti Nidesha it sort of lifts off from the historical plane into the mythic. We're suddenly in another a realm altogether with this text. And later Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, talked very much in terms of imagination and myth and stories that try and give you a flavour of what enlightenment is like in images and parables rather than just in sort of straightforward doctrinal teachings. And the Vimalakirti Nidesha does that. Actually, it does have doctrinal teachings, but larger than that, it has these incredible images and stories and weird happenings. And Vimalakirti is at the centre of it all. So it starts off with the Buddha teaching or the Buddha in a particular place surrounded by hundreds, thousands of disciples. But then the action moves to near where the Buddha is, a town called Vaishali, and Vimalakirti is in Vaishali, and he's a bit like a Doctor Who character. That's the only... Well, in fact, he is like Doctor Who. he appears to be ordinary. And he appears as a layman, a businessman, in Vaishali, living in a house with a family. He's got a wife and children. Just going about his ordinary business. He's well-liked and respected in the town. But he's not who you think he is at all. And over the course of the next 6 or 8 weeks, we'll unfold some of what happens to everybody who encounters Vimalakirti. He starts to, I'll just give you a sort of wee taste of some of the things that happen, and then I want to move back to more general kind of principles. He starts to challenge some of the Buddha's disciples in a way that they've never been challenged before, including some of the disciples who are very, very senior, and even some of the bodhisattvas around the Buddha. He becomes sick, for example. Vimalakirti doesn't go and see the Buddha, and he sends his apologies because he says he's sick. And the Buddha knows that Vimalakirti's sick, but not really, and sends people to see him to inquire after his health. And Vimalakirti is sort of sick and sort of not. His sickness is a teaching. Everything about Vimalakirti is a teaching. And when he's asked why he's sick, he says, well, I'm sick because all beings are sick. He's sick out of empathy for unenlightened beings. And there's a scene in the text where a bodhisattva and lots of the Buddha's disciples sort of go to Vimalakirti's house, and Vimalakirti magically clears his house so that it's empty apart from him on a sick bed. And then all these people come, and Ananda starts to, or Shariputra starts to worry about where they're all going to sit. And suddenly Vimalakirti magics 3,200,000 chairs, or actually they're not chairs, they're giant thrones of cosmic proportions. And he magics them from a universe, well, another Buddha land, another dimension, another universe, into his house, which is a one-room house. And they completely all fit. Everything fits inside the house, and everybody can sit. And then, of course, there's the question of it's nearly lunchtime. And so what's everybody going to eat? Yeah, so a big deal in monastic circles in India, because you have to eat before noon, otherwise you don't eat that day. So it's coming on to noon, and there's now 3,200,000 people all sitting on massive thrones. And Vimalakirti sends somebody to another Buddha land, another sort of universe, where there's a Buddha, different to our Buddha, who is constantly teaching all his disciples. And in this Buddha land, the Buddha doesn't teach in words, because words are too sort of crude. Instead, he teaches by using fragrances. So it's all the Dharma is taught through scent, and people become enlightened through fragrance. And Vimalakirti asks for some food from this fragrant Buddha land, and it comes in a jar, smelling beautiful, and it completely nourishes all 3,200,000 people in Vimalakirti's room, and there's food left over. The text is very clear about that. There's food left over. There's some of the sort of things that Vimalakirti just kind of seems to do while sort of lying sick. And then he also gets into dialogue with some of the Buddha's disciples about what is the nature of existence, what is the nature of reality. And it's as if He is manifesting the nature of reality, showing people the nature of reality, rather than just talking about it. He is teaching through his whole life and experience. And so I'm going to start looking at how we might understand the nature of reality as Vimalakirti kind of teaches it. But Bandhe, Sangharakshita, starts off by talking about another quality of enlightenment. So another title for this text, which is known as the Vimalakirti Nidesha, another title for it is the Achintya Vimoksha. The Achintya Vimoksha. And Vimoksha means freedom or emancipation. And Achintya means inconceivable. So another title for this text is the Inconceivable Emancipation. And that's the title that Bandhe has used in his book. And so he starts off by talking about freedom as the goal of the Dharma life. Freedom as the goal of the Dharma life. And I think that's really just worth pausing and reflecting upon. Because I don't know about you, but most people who come to the Dharma, and I probably could include myself, I think I do, yes, I'm not sure that I thought in terms of freedom when I came to the Buddhist Centre. I think most people that I encounter who come to the Buddhist Centre think in terms, if they think at all about the goal, you probably think more in terms of happiness and fulfilment. Am I right? We're all gonna you're all gonna be too clever by half and say that you were thinking in terms of freedom. Well, anyway, I'm telling you that most people think in terms of happiness, and they're wrong. Not you, of course. Just most people. Not that Buddhism doesn't make you happy. Happier. I mean, it should do. It does do. If you practice meditation, if you practice ethics, you will find yourself becoming generally more positive in life. Your mind will become brighter, and if your mind is more positive and bright, then generally your life will be happier. But the reason that I think happiness is a bit of a sort of wrong kind of conception. Is that because when we think of happiness, at least when I think of happiness, I think of getting what I want. I think that if I get what I want, I'll be happy. That is quite a common nod, everybody. That's quite a common thing, isn't it, to think that you will get happy when you get what you want. And what sort of things do we think we want? I mean, not you, of course, but most money, people.
Love.
Sorry?
Money.
Money.
Love.
House. Love. Love, yes. Money, house, love.
Cake.
Cake. Thank you. Thank you. Somebody after my own heart. Money, house, love, cake.
Success.
That kind of covers it. Success. Oh, yes, success.
Good health.
Good health, yeah.
Peace of mind.
Peace of mind, yeah.
Endless pleasure.
Endless pleasure. Who said that? Yes, endless.
Not me.
No, not you. No. Endless pleasure. I like that one. That feels like quite a deep-seated motivation. Endless pleasure. And you kind of think, oh, the money, the house, the love, the cake. Most of the other things are going to provide. Or they're part of that endless pleasure, aren't they? They're going to be part of it. Peace of mind can help as well. Endless pleasure, I like the sound of that. But Buddhism doesn't offer you that. Unfortunately, it doesn't offer you that sort of happiness. You know how in a theistic religion, you can have petitionary prayer. You can pray for things. You know, and in a sort of very popular kind of theistic kind of if theistic tradition at a popular level, you might pray even for the house, the cake, the... Do you know what I mean? You can find yourself praying for those things. Well, Buddhism is saying if you practice Buddhism, it's not that you will get everything that you desire. It's not quite like that. You might, but life doesn't tend to give you everything you want. Life just isn't like that. What Buddhism says is that your mind, if you practice Buddhism, will become more and more expansive and positive till ultimately it doesn't matter whether you get what you want or not. It doesn't matter what life throws at you or not. Life can be painful and still your mind will remain positive. Yeah? Still your mind will remain equanimous. It will still be bright and clear and friendly and kind. It might not always be sort of happy in the sense that you can be happy when you get what you want, but it will be fulfilled, it will be at peace, it will be equanimous, it will be free. Now that is the true freedom. A freedom of mind that doesn't depend upon the conditions in your life. That's what Buddhism promises. It promises that sort of freedom. It doesn't promise getting what you want. In fact, it teaches that you won't get what you want. Not completely, because life just doesn't ever give us complete satisfaction. So part of the freedom comes from deeply realizing that trying to get complete satisfaction from finite things isn't ever going to work. So Buddhism's promising freedom, not happiness in the sense of getting what you kind of want. In that freedom, there is real fulfillment. And it's even said that there's bliss. There's a sort of joy, a deep, deep fulfillment and a joy. But it's not necessarily always the same as getting what you want. For example, it won't always be pleasurable. The Buddha himself, when he was old and close to the death of his body, was in pain, physical pain. His back was painful. He had all sorts of excruciating pains close to his death. So even the Buddha couldn't, as it were, get endless pleasure, because life doesn't offer you that. Not when we've got a physical form, a physical body. Can't, in a physical world, can't get it. Can't get endless fulfillment and pleasure. But your mind can be free of it. Your mind can be elevated to a state where, even though there's physical pain, your mind is not touched by it. Yeah, not affected by it. Now that sort of freedom starts to touch on the inconceivable, because it is so, that sort of mind state is so different to our ordinary, normal mind state, that when we're in our ordinary, kind of everyday mind, it is inconceivable that you could be radiantly fulfilled and in pain. It's sort of inconceivable. We cannot really imagine what a mind of enlightened freedom is like, what that feels like. So it's inconceivable. It's an inconceivable emancipation. But then Bhante talks about how even closer to home, any new state of mind is sort of inconceivable to where we are now. If you're feeling really low, it probably feels inconceivable that you'll ever get out of that. You know, you might know it intellectually, but at gut level, it feels inconceivable. If you're feeling radiantly happy, you know, you're in love and everything's going your way, it probably feels inconceivable that that will end. Intellectually, again, you might know, but it's as if our heart expects the current state to just carry on forever, maybe with a little bit of improvement. And then Bhante talks about inconceivable in another way. So let me see if I can start to talk about why experience is inconceivable. So what Bhante starts to talk about is that the magical happenings in Vimalakirti's presence, the magical things that Vimalakirti conjures up, are pointing to a deep, deep truth about the nature of reality. One of the ways of understanding this is that experience is always magical. Experience is always magical. So let's start to think about in what way might that be true? In what way is experience always magical? Because probably, frankly, most of the time, your experience and my experience doesn't feel magical. It probably feels pretty humdrum. If you're travelling on the Central Line to Bethnal Green, it's hard to imagine that that's, you know, you're tinged with magic. Probably it doesn't feel like that. So in what way might experience always be magical? Does anybody have a clue?
Yeah, if you're completely present.
Yes, so say more to that. And then what happens? And
very aware and conscious of it.
Yes. And then why so in what way does experience become magical? What's the experience like when you're really present, you're really aware, you're in the moment? What changes for you?
I'm happier.
Right, you're happier. Yeah.
I'm happy at that moment.
At that moment.
And it happens quite a lot.
Yeah, you're happy in the moment.
In those moments, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And is that, do you have a sense, sorry?
When those moments happen.
Do you have a sense in those moments, I'm guessing that you do, that you feel happy regardless of what's happening?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in that sense, you've got a taste, a glimpse of what this freedom is like, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Anybody else, in what sense is experience magical all the time? To you. Who said that? Say more.
So, I think that if you appreciate a moment just for what it is,
yeah,
and realise how fortunate you are to be in that moment,
yeah,
I think that creates a sense of magic,
yes,
around it, because you could be anywhere else in the world, but you're right there experiencing that.
Yes, so that's in a way allied to this being present. It's not just being present in this kind of neutral way. There's also something about appreciation of what's happening in the moment. And that, to me, implies, I don't know, that there's some sort of perspective. And in that larger perspective, you start to see that, oh, you're alive, and this means something, this has value. This sort of ordinary experience has value. I'm reminded of, do you remember Brian Keenan's book, An Evil Cradling? Do you remember that? He was imprisoned in...
That's right. A serial murderer.
No. He was sort of innocent, but he was a hostage. He was imprisoned, I think, in Iran,
yes.
Possibly. Anyway, he was kept. I wasn't going to talk about this, so I can barely remember it because I read it decades ago. Anyway, he's kept in solitary confinement for years, often in horrific conditions with a lot of fear and in the dark. And he writes about this. He was eventually freed, and He writes this very, very powerful, moving memoir called An Evil Cradling. Anyway, if I remember rightly, there's a point in this memoir about a time when he's imprisoned, and I think he's in solitary confinement, and for some reason he's given a gift. The guards allow him a gift. And this gift that he's given is an orange. So suddenly he is in possession of an orange, something that you and I would take as something very, very ordinary. And he describes this experience of just holding this orange and seeing the orange of the orange. And it's so beautiful. He can't bear to peel it, to eat it. It's like this jewel. I can't remember how he describes it. But it's like a magical experience from another dimension has just come into his experience, his life. Very, very moving, him describing this experience of eating an orange. And I think I'm just reminded of that by you talking about being present and you talking about appreciation. And in that, everything can become magical. You had your hand up. Did you have anything?
Yeah,
more?
I was thinking along a very similar line.
Yeah.
Sort of gratitude that you're filled with when you come to fully inhabit a moment.
Yeah.
A gratitude that you're actually inhabiting that moment and you are recognizing that.
Yeah.
And but then there's also something I think. There's an element of empathy that comes in as well, I think.
Yes, there is.
I'm just thinking about the tube situation and kind of, realizing that, starting to really feel for those beings around you.
Yeah.
For how their lives and existences are as well.
Yes.
And, there's something about that.
Yes.
For me.
Yes. Yeah. I think you're right. And I think what you're getting at is, all of you are getting at, by being more present, what can arise is not just a cool kind of appreciation, but gratitude and empathy for all of life, and even a sense of love, well, metta that then arises. And much of our training in the Dharma is training in developing these qualities of being present, being aware, being appreciative, being grateful, having a broader perspective on our lives so that we can be grateful of the ordinary. cultivating metta and empathy. All of those qualities would naturally be there in the enlightened mind. This side of enlightenment, we can cultivate those qualities through practice. And the more we cultivate them, the more experience starts to be touched with this sense of magic. Yeah. But I want to start to talk about magic in another sense. Magic here is being used as a metaphor for something to do with the nature of all experience. Actually, before I touch on that, I was just reminded of me as a kid, as a boy. I was very much inspired by wanting to be a magician. I don't mean a magician in the Paul Daniels sense. I mean in the, I don't know, Harry Potter sense of a wizard. I was going to be a wizard, and I was going to... I spent an awful lot of time, it seems, trying to turn coal dust into diamonds by heating in a big dustbin, creating a fire. And I was an alchemist, basically. I was about seven, and me and Tony Boyce would create fires in dustbins, heating coal dust, And there was a theory that we would create diamonds and then we would be rich. And yeah, nothing particular ever happened, but we did spend an awful lot of time. I also know that I was quite frightened of Katie, who lived opposite. She was a friend of Paul's, she was his older sister, a bit older than me, and I, for some reason, convinced myself that she was a witch. There were broomsticks in their garden, and Katie was obviously, you know, familiar with how to ride a broomstick. So there was all this kind of imaginative... You know, I lived in a suburban street in North London, but it was actually occupied by all sorts of spirits and demons. And Katie was sort of, I don't know, mistress of some of the darker forces in the street. She was only about 12. And, you know, as a very young boy, I asked for a magic set and was given one for Christmas. And can remember, you know, opening it very, very excitedly and rushing to turn my sister into a rabbit or hedgehog or something, frog probably, and realizing that the wand didn't quite work. And later on that day, becoming very, very disappointed when I realized that actually it was a box of tricks, not magic, and there were all these instructions and you had to read things. That wasn't quite what I wanted out of magic. So I grew up with this boyhood kind of wonder at, I don't know, just wanting magic in my life. And later on I went on to study physics because I was fascinated by the fact that we really didn't know what was going on, and that space and time and matter were not what we thought they were, and that we live, even from a scientific perspective, we live in a magical world, that we really don't have a clue as to what's going on. And then later when I came across the Dharma, I was very, very excited because not only was Buddhism saying similar things to modern physics, but Buddhism was saying that yes, you couldn't really conceive of what was going on, but you could experience it. Through enlightenment, we could develop a mind that could experience the truth, even though it was beyond all conceiving. And that, to me, was a real motivating, and still is, a sort of motivating force in my life. And if I can just start to sort of show you that we really don't know what's going on, you know, you can see these flowers, can't you? You can see yellow and red, but you know that the flowers aren't really yellow and red. Do you know that? Do you know that colour is happening in your mind? Yeah? And do you know that if your eyes were different, you would see differently? You might not see the colours as they are. Colour is a phenomenon that is partly mind-made. Something might be going on over there, but it's not colour as we experience it. The experience is mind-made. Yeah? Does that make sense to you? Well, it's not just like that with colour. It's like that with every experience that you can have through any of your physical senses. Anything that you can feel, touch, smell, taste, see, hear, is partly mind-made. Yeah? And the part that isn't mind-made, you don't know what's there. You don't know what's there. You don't know what it's like to be a flower without the redness or the yellowness, without the colour. And yet we know that colour is not intrinsic in the object. It's an appearance in the mind. So you don't know what's out there apart from what we can perceive. And we can only perceive things through the senses that we've got. And the senses that we've got don't reveal the truth. They just reveal what they can reveal. Yeah? So we don't know what reality is out independent of our perceptions of it. We know nothing about anything. Bhante makes this point in his commentary. He says it's not like we know a little bit about the nature of reality. He says we don't know anything about anything. Yeah? So that's the position that we're in. We don't know anything about anything. So when you start to think like that, experience is magical. There is an appearance of flowers, but we don't know what they are. We don't know what's really out there at all, if anything is out there at all. And Vimlakirti starts to illustrate that even our notions of space and time are mind-made. Space isn't out there, separate to experience, and time isn't out there, separate to experience, and our experience is mind-made. So even this world of form that seems to exist so independently of us in space and time, none of that is independent of mind, of consciousness. And enlightenment would be not just an understanding of that intellectually, it would be a seeing of that directly, because we would then be in a state of consciousness that wasn't dependent on mind, on time and space and form. There would be something in that state that was independent of all of those constructs. And it's said that there is the possibility of an experience, a type of consciousness, a state of mind, an awareness that isn't limited by time and space and by conditions, by form. And when Vimlakirti magics up 3,200,000 thrones and fits them all into his room, the text is trying to illustrate the relative nature of space. Because when you're in this state, it said, when you're in this enlightened consciousness, it's that consciousness, because it's not in time and space, it's not like it is within time and space, it's like time and space are within it. Yeah? Time and space and this phenomenal universe with its billions of stars and galaxies and light years of space, all of that is within consciousness, not consciousness within it. So from that perspective, this state of mind contains everything. It contains the whole thing, all of time, all of space, and everything within time and space is contained within enlightened awareness. And enlightened awareness can be experienced by all of us, somehow within time and space. So you get this, you get these weird things of everything containing everything. Am I losing you? There's a later Buddhist teaching. There's a later Buddhist teaching which is a teaching in the Huayan school, which talks about the mutual interpenetration of all phenomena. And it gives beautiful illustrations of this. And one illustration is the image of Indra's net. And in Indra's net, it's an image where Indra's net is a net that spans the whole phenomenal cosmos. But it's not just an ordinary net, it's a net of jewels. So at every juncture of the net, and it's in all dimensions and all takes up all space, in all dimensions, at every juncture there's a jewel. And the incredible thing about Indra's net is that in every jewel, if you look, you can see reflected every other jewel. Every other jewel is contained in a reflection in every jewel. And it's as if every jewel is, I don't know, is form. It's this, it's you, it's me, it's form. And somehow within each form, which we think of as separate in time and space, from the perspective of enlightened consciousness, every form contains everything. In this vast enlightened awareness, everything is contained. I can remember asking Sangharakshita about this. I can remember some years ago, I was fortunate enough to be on a study retreat with him, and I think I was taking him his lunch or something. So I happened to have just a few minutes sort of alone with him as I took him his lunch. And I said, look, I wanted to take the opportunity. And I said, look, Bhante, I'm starting to really see, I think I was seeing at the time anyway, who knows, the truth of impermanence and insubstantiality and unsatisfactoriness, the lakshanas as they're called. But I'm really not sure how should I reflect on this teaching of the mutual interpenetration of all phenomena. Can you give me a clue? Anyway, we got straight to the point because I only had a few minutes. Can you give me a clue? And he looked at me with his eyes that probably can't see very much. Well, they can't see very much, but he looked as if he was looking, seeing straight at me, even through me. And he didn't answer my question. I wanted some sort of tips as to how should I reflect. And he just looked and said, he said, yes, all things contain all things. Huh? And that was it. And that was the interview over. And Bhante doesn't mince his words. Every word is weighted. He only says things that he really means. So when he said, all things contain all things, that sort of went in as true. Now it's in this sense that the world is magical. And the only thing that stops us from experiencing it as magical in this sense is our delusion of separateness. We take this phenomenal kind of appearance as real, and in this appearance, this world of appearance, this body seems to be separate from the rest of the world. And then I identify with this body, and my mind immediately shrinks to the confines of this body, which I imagine is separate from the rest of the universe. And instead of this expansion of consciousness, what we've done is imprison ourselves in this world of form, which we take literally as real. And then we look for fulfillment in it. Yeah? And of course, nothing is going to completely fulfill. Another way of talking about the way things really are is that it's not that this phenomenal experience of form and colour and shape and sound and touch, it's not that that isn't happening. It is happening. So it's not that it's completely non-existent or completely unreal. It is happening. You are there, I am here. You know, we're not merged into one sort of united union of soup or something like that. It's, you know, there is a sort of relative reality, but it's not ultimately real. That's what Buddhism's saying. It's somehow illusory and mind-made. And an analogy that is used, well, I'm going to use two analogies. The first one that is used is that it's like having a dream. And when you're having a dream, it feels very real. It feels very real until the moment you wake up. And then when you wake up, you realize that that experience of the dream, it did happen in experience, but it was a mind-made experience. It happened, it was a creation of the mind. It wasn't as real as your waking experience. Yeah? Well, what Vimalakirti is teaching is that this waking experience is like a collective dream. It too is mind-made. It too is mind-made at a different level of reality. And the reason that we take it for, as real is because we haven't woken up. Just as if in a dream you haven't woken up and you take it for real, yeah? Enlightenment is about waking up. And if you wake up, it's as if you would be... it's a bit analogous to lucid dreaming. Have you ever had a lucid dream? I'm not sure I have, but I might have touched on it once. A lucid dream was where you carry on dreaming, but you know that you're dreaming. You know that you are in a dream, yeah? And then you're free. You're still having the dream, but you're completely free in that dream. And you could do anything you wanted. You could fly, you could meet the Buddha, you could gain enlightenment. You could do whatever you wanted. Probably most people do silly things rather than gain enlightenment. But you can, in a lucid dream, dream your dream. Yeah? Because you know you're dreaming. So you're not at the mercy of the dream. You know you're dreaming. And even if, in a lucid dream, things happen that you don't like, you wouldn't be affected because you know that they're dreamlike. So enlightenment would be like that. It would be like you'd still have a body and you'd still have the experience of touch and taste and sight and things that the body give you. But an enlightened mind would be awake and it would know that this phenomenal world and its experiences are dreamlike. So that anything that then happened in this life wouldn't be taken too seriously. Do you see what I mean? Because it's not ultimately real. It would be as if life was like a magic show or a dream. And because you were free of the delusion of the magic show, you wouldn't be affected by it, but also you might be able to manipulate it. And Vimalakirti can certainly manipulate space and time and form. I'm not sure whether, you know, if he was real, he could do that. But that's what he's trying to illustrate, that the world of imagination isn't bound by space and time and form. And actually, the world of imagination is as real as anything else. Because when you see this flower and you see the red and the yellow on the other flower, that experience of seeing the colour is an imaginative act. It's happening in the mind. Your mind is creating your experience. So if you imagine something else, that is as real. Buddhism is saying everything is happening through the mind. So the world of the imagination is potentially as real as waking experience. Yeah?
Yeah. In Western cultures, that can lead to being regarded as psychiatric problems.
Yes, that's right. So you could go...
Sorry, can I just add just that I think also in the physical world,
Let me answer this first, and then you can add to that, because otherwise we'll get lost. So I think in our culture we don't really know about these other types of we don't really know the power of the mind, apart from maybe through drugs, hallucinogenic drugs, or through mental illness. And Buddhism's saying that it's not like you need to... Enlightenment wouldn't be like mental illness and it wouldn't be like being on hallucinogenic drugs. And yet, there might be parallels in that you wouldn't be limited to just perceiving reality as it appears to you. having said that, it's not, you know, a Buddha while he had his, while he was still in, embodied, his five senses would have operated just like yours and mine. But the mind wouldn't have taken those as literally true. Yeah. Sorry, yeah, go on, sir.
I was going to say that I think that we are also limited by our physical limitations in terms of how
yes.
the mind perceives itself and ourselves. So I think when you were talking, I thought that some of the things that you were saying were contradicting our own ego and how we separate ourselves from others, which is important from our survival. So for example, if you were left in a national park where the lions are, right, you wouldn't feel that you're part of that, and your mind wouldn't tell you that you're part of that world.
And let the lions eat you or something.
Exactly. There would be that survival instinct that you have to kind of separate yourself.
So I think... That touches on something very, very profound, and I'm going to try and I haven't got very much time left, but I'm going to try and touch on it because I think it's something very important. It's as if we're existing on different levels, yeah. So this physical body does exist at a particular level of reality, and a lion's body also exists at that same level. Both are at the same sort of plane of reality, and so while you're in a physical body, while you have a physical body can come to harm if a lion eats you, and so a Buddha wouldn't just try and avoid being just try and let himself be eaten by a lion. He would avoid being eaten by a lion, because he knows that the physical body exists at the same level of reality as the lion does. And at the same time, his mind, an enlightened mind, I'm told, wouldn't identify with the physical body, wouldn't see themselves as the same as the physical body. So if the physical body happened to be eaten, the enlightened mind wouldn't be bothered. So it's as if we occupy different levels, yeah? We do have this level, this world of form, and at the physical level, we are separate. There is separate form. Although even that, if you look closely, the boundaries aren't so rigid as we normally think they are. You just take the mindfulness of breathing. And we're all breathing in this air and breathing it out. The air becomes part of our body, and then we exhale. We're always interacting with our environment. There isn't a clear-cut boundary that separates me from environment. That's what it is to be alive. We're always a process in connection with other processes. But What Buddhism is saying is that the physical body and the physical world isn't the only reality. And enlightenment would know that. And therefore it wouldn't be strictly identified with that. And that in that would be a freedom. In that would be a freedom because at this physical level things will go wrong. The body will go wrong. And we won't be able to get all the things we want and need. Let me finish. I'm going to actually not be able to take more questions because I've literally only got 2 minutes and I've got to wrap up. So at this physical level, it's not going to fulfill us. Most of our lives, we try and find fulfillment at that physical level. And we will always end up not completely fulfilled. What Buddhism's saying is that does carry on. It's not that that is completely non-existent. This physical world of form is relatively real, but it's not the deepest reality. It's not the deepest reality. At a deeper level, the mind, there's something in our mind, in consciousness, that isn't bound by physical form. It's not even bound by space and time. There's an aspect of consciousness that is unbounded, outside of space and time. And in that aspect of consciousness, it's as if space and time are within it, and all this world of form is within it. And we can experience this unbounded consciousness while still having a physical body. So that's an incredible thing, to have a finite body and an infinite mind, or a mind that's completely outside of space and time. If you can experience that mind, it's a deeper level of reality than this world of space and time and form. And then you're no longer completely identified with this world of space and time and form. And whatever happens in this world of time and form, it can't affect that freedom of mind. Even death can't affect it. It's not ever possible to affect it in a negative way. It's unbounded. It's unsullied. And the incredible thing is that that consciousness, state of mind, awareness, we don't have words for it, because it's not a thing, because things only exist in space and time. However you talk about it, you falsify it. But that awareness, enlightened mind, let's call it enlightened mind, is, is the true nature of all things. It's not just that human beings can experience it. That is the true nature of this flower, of this glass of water, of these walls, of this phenomenal world. If you could see things as they really are, if you could see a single blade of grass as it really is, you'd see that it is a manifestation of this enlightened mind. That everything is alive with enlightened mind. Everything is a manifestation of enlightened mind. So then this distinction between this world of form and a world beyond form, even that starts to break down. There is only this experience, and this experience is of enlightenment, and it's magical. Everything is magical. Everything is alive. And everything contains all things. And this world of space and time is relatively real, but not absolutely real. And when you can experience that, you experience an empathy, as you were saying, with all form, with all phenomena. You see everything as alive. And because you experience an empathy with it, it's of the same mind. Everything is, you just feel metaphor. There's no opposition possible. And there's a real, real freedom. And I want to finish with a quote from Einstein, which I've read before, but I think he gets at this. And you have to remember that Einstein, all his life, worked to try and uncover the truth about this world of form and space and time. You know, he was concerned as a physicist with what is matter, what is space, what is time. And his theory, particularly of relativity, overturned our notions of space and time as being objective and out there. Yeah, he wrote in a letter of condolence to the wife of a good friend of his who had died. He wrote, he said something like, "He has gone a little way ahead of me, but that means nothing." He said, "To us physicists who believe in physics, we know that the past, the present, and the future are nothing but a persistent illusion." He knew through his theories that time and space were not objectively real. And later on, physics has shown that form, that matter, isn't objective in the way that we think it is. And but Einstein was more than just a great scientist. I think he was a visionary. And the words that I'm going to read out could be Buddhist, could be pure Dharma. He knew about Buddhism, and he had said that of all the religions that he knew about, Buddhism came closest to talking about the truth. And he talks in this passage about us being imprisoned. And the imprisonment is of our own making. It's of our mind's making. It's because we don't see things as they are that we live in a prison. And then we, in that prison, we take it as real and everything becomes sort of ordinary. If we could expand our mind, our world would expand. And he sees, Einstein in this passage sees that as what life is about. That's what we're here to do. We're here to expand our mind till it becomes unbounded, till we see things as they really are, till everything becomes magical. And then the only way to live would be to live from metta and wonder. So let me finish this. I'll read it twice. Einstein wrote it using he and the male pronoun, and I'll read it as he wrote it, and then I'll read it using she, if I can. So you can hear it twice. Yeah. And then we'll finish. A human being is part of a whole called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to the affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in all its beauty. Nobody is able to achieve this completely, but the striving for such an achievement is in itself a part of the liberation and a foundation for inner security. That's wonderful, isn't it? Buddhism would say that actually you can achieve this completely. That's what an enlightened being is, somebody who has achieved this completely. But let me read it again. A human being is part of a whole, called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. She experiences herself, her thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of her consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to the affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion, to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in all its beauty. Nobody is able to achieve this completely, but the striving for such an achievement is in itself a part of the liberation and a foundation for inner security. Good. So thank you very much. Next week, we'll have Padma Vajra as our special guest speaker. Really worth coming to listen to Padma Vajra. And he's going to be exploring, as it were, the first story or the first part of this text, the Vimlakirti Nidesha. I've just given you a bit of a background and a clue as to the sort of themes of magic and imagination and freedom that we're going to be exploring. Thanks very much. Thank you.